It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Wisconsin Historical Society's Ojibwe Storytelling Series, it showcases winter storytelling season. This is an ancient art passed from one generation to the next in Native communities. And the series, it features four women storytellers and concludes Tuesday. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Liz Arbuckle is a senior member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Tribal Council and Northern Outreach Coordinator for the Wisconsin Historical Society. Liz, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, bring us closer to winter, if you will. Why is it a special time for storytelling in Ojibwe culture?
Right. This is, it's our storytelling season for a few reasons, right? I've heard a few different stories about why we choose to do this, but I'm going to get one out of the way, first of all, which is the practical side of things, right? So back in the day, you know, survival was key. And we didn't have grocery stores or anything nearby. So you had to make hay while the sun shined, to use an expression, and get your resources, get your rice, your maple syrup, everything ready for winter. And then when winter came, which was harder to find food, harder to be out, you know, it was a time where you could relax and share stories and teachings. So some of that is the logical, or, you know, I guess what you would think of as that. Mm-hmm. And then another aspect is there's some stories we can only tell in winter. And as I've been told, it's because that's the quiet time. That's when lots of animals are sleeping. That's when a lot of our spirits are sleeping. Everybody's just kind of holed up because it's cold and snowy in Wisconsin and other parts of Ojibwe country. And so it's a good time when we can talk and have those conversations. So we chose at the Society winter because of that, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm Ojibwe, I'm Bad River, and I decided to let's give this a go. And the thing I love about this series, we started a few years ago, is not only do they share stories, but just by where we place these stories, that we're placing them in winter, we are communicating the importance of that cultural aspect, that there are some stories we share that can only be told in the winter, for example. So I like that it kind of offers that little aspect to it.
Yes. And why are the stories often about nature and woodland animals, like the hibernating animals?
Yeah, we have a few different ways of, they're not necessarily about, oh, I see what you're saying. I thought you meant they were about hibernating. We do have a lot of animal stories, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. We do have a lot of more of their characters. But when we think about that, I'm thinking about Nana Buju, which is kind of our trickster. And he's the guy we don't talk about, certainly outside of winter. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, every culture, or I think most cultures, have tricksters in their lore, and they all have their own aspects about them and what they do and what naughtiness they get up to. And so that's one of the ones we don't really share, because we don't want to invite him in and make trouble for us, especially during the winter. So,
and he's a recurring character. He shows up in some of these stories again and again. There was one about the maple tree, the spirit of the maple tree. And
yep, he shows up in a lot of things. You know, original man there, not quite human, not quite God. Trickster, and he does all sorts of nonsense and naughtiness. But all of those stories, or a lot of those stories, I can't say all of them, I haven't heard all of them, but they're really about what not to do. So even though he's kind of a naughty character a lot of the times and making mischief, we still respect him because he's teaching us by his own naughtiness what not to do. And that's one of the things I love about our Ojibwe folklore is, you know, we do have a lot of like lesson stories, like you should eat this, not that, you know, all these things that are going to help keep us alive, and how to be a good person and a kind person. But we still respect Nana Buju because he is his teaching us in that way, that he's going through all these mistakes that we can learn from. So that's still a very, very important part. It's not like he's, I don't know, like the bad guy or something, like you might see in other stories. He's not the villain. He's there to teach us a lesson.
A lesson, yes. Liz Arbuckle with us as we talk about winter storytelling season. Liz is Northern Outreach Coordinator for the Wisconsin Historical Society. You can join in with questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Liz, what is your earliest memory of listening to someone tell you a winter story or to, you know, reciting some oral history?
Oh gosh. Well, I grew up on Bad River, where I still reside. I've been off and about a little bit, but here I'm back. I guess you grew up that way. You know, we hear it in the home. We hear stories, of course, from our elders, from our grandparents, aunties, uncles, parents, Head Start. I got a lot of new lessons because you've got family stories or stories they share, and then you go out and you hear things from other folks. So I'd say it started it all pretty very early on, and it's always been an interest of mine, right? And so I was glad to be able to share the series with folks.
What?
And one of the things I wanted to do with this series was make sure all six bands get represented. We have four per year, and they have been, which is wonderful. And but all of our storytellers, I'd say, I don't even think half would say I'm a storyteller, you know. Most of them are like, oh gosh, I'm not a storyteller. But everybody has stories, right? And once you sit down and you start thinking about it, they have a lot of amazing, interesting things to say and lots of great stories to share. And that, of course, is, I think, one aspect of our tribe, of our people. You know, we can be kind of humble about things like that. And you don't want to put yourself forward and be like, oh yeah, I know what I'm, you know. So it takes a lot of courage for these folks. And I've learned so much from them.
And this series is all women storytellers.
Yeah, this year it is all women. That was kind of, you know, the first year we had three men and one woman. The next year we went 2-2. This year it was supposed to be three women and one man, but he unfortunately couldn't follow through on that commitment. And I'd made the joke because, of course, I'm behind the series that I'm like, well, if anybody drops out, you know, I'm going to be your substitute. And lo and behold, it happened this year. So I'm like, okay, now it's time for me to step up to the plate. So that's just kind of how it worked out. But I love it because, especially our ladies, we don't often hear them on stages. You know what I mean? They're some of the best storytellers when it's just personal and sitting around the kitchen table. Or, you know, the living room, and they laugh and they're great storytellers. But I know I've noticed a trend that we don't see a lot of women doing that, right? So the whole aspect of this is I wanted to showcase and introduce Wisconsin people to Native or Ojibwe people as I know them. Right, as just these lovely people that I see when I go to a feast or to a store or just for a walk in the community. We have so much amazing resources and talents in our own communities that maybe aren't published authors or academics, but they have so much to share. And that's what I love about this series is that we're able to do that.
Oh, that connection is so beautiful. Liz Arbuckle, senior member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Tribal Council, our guide to winter storytelling season in this series from the Wisconsin Historical Society. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore how in Ojibwe culture, stories, they're told all year long, but winter especially is the season for storytelling. And the Wisconsin Historical Society's Ojibwe Storytelling Series, it elevates the voices of women storytellers throughout this month. You can call in with a question, share your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Liz Arbuckle is a senior member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Tribal Council and a storyteller in the series. And Liz, we asked you to bring a short story to share. Would you mind?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
I'd love to. It was a little hard because I'm like, geez, what story can I tell at 7 o'clock in the morning? But I think I'm, you know, because some of these are kind of cozy up at night stories. But I've decided to share this story that was actually from my friend Val Barber. She taught me this one. She's one of our storytellers from last year. She's an Ojibwe language teacher. She taught my daughter Ojibwe language during COVID. Which is kind of how this series started. You know, we're trying to bring these stories right into your home so you can just log on Tuesday night and listen to me, and you can log on and listen to our former storytellers on our Historical Society YouTube page. Mm-hmm. So if you want to catch any of these other people, please do. But this story was taught to me by Val, and she said I could use it. And I love it because it's my daughter's favorite story. So the one she taught. And it's about Wawatasi, right? This little insect. So Wawatasi was out down by the river, just kind of chilling. He's watching all the goings on, you know, on the river. He's watching the swan take off. And he's watching the heron stand so beautifully. And then the heron takes off. But he's just a little ordinary looking gray bug. And he's just like, call me jeepers. You know, everybody, they're so beautiful and elegant and graceful. And here I just sit. And then as he's thinking these kind of sad thoughts, a loon starts up. And he's like, oh, good grief. Now this guy is serenading and he sounds beautiful. I'm just still this gray bug. And then the frogs start going. Right. And the frogs start jumping and hopping, and boy, they're having a good time. He's like, I can't do any of these things. So he's like, well, I'm going to try jumping. I think I can jump. Right. So he goes and he jumps, and all he ends up doing is falling off his leaf, not very gracefully, and on the ground. And now he's just super sad. So he's like, well, doggone it. Now what am I going to do? I wish I could just go home and give up, go back to bed. And all of a sudden, he heard this breeze came through, and he hears this on the wind, and it's the creator. And the creator's like, oh, Wawatasi, Wawatasi, why do you say you're not good at anything? He's like, why am I even here, creator? I'm not good at anything. I don't do anything for anybody. And he goes, oh, no, no, no. Embrace yourself. Love yourself. Don't have to fly gracefully or sing so pretty or jump so good. That's their talents. That's their gifts. That's what they do. But look inside yourself. Give yourself a hug. Just give yourself a hug. He's like, well, I don't know about this. He's like, trust me, I'm the creator. And he's like, okay. So little Wawatasi gives himself a little hug. And he's like, okay, well, that didn't do much. And he's like, no, come on, really believe it. Put your heart into it. Give yourself a really good hug. So Wawatasi gave himself a big hug. And he says, okay, now say, I can do it. I'm good. I'm here on this earth. I can do lots of good things. I'm important. And he's like, perfect. That's what we want to hear, Wawatasi. And he gave himself a really good hug. And then all of a sudden, boop, his little hind end lit up. It turns out that Wawatasi was a firefly. Oh. But he didn't know that. And then the creator said, see, you have an amazing gift and talent. Who else can do this? Who else can do this light up business? And he's like, okay, he goes, now go and tell your other friends and show them how, teach them how. And so he did. And the lesson, of course, is, you know, don't be sad and dissatisfied with who you are or where you're at or what you're doing. You have abilities you may not even have discovered yet. It's so important to keep you on this planet. It's so important what you have to contribute to this whole animal world, or in our case, the human world and animal world. So just keep embracing yourself and loving yourself and see just what might happen.
Oh, that was
And I
so
love that story so
beautiful.
much
Oh.
because she taught it to my daughter during, the beginning stages of COVID when we were all stuck home. And when we all needed that story, when we're all feeling sad and lonely and like, geez, I don't know what to do with myself. So it's a great story to share with others. It's a great story and a reminder for all of us. So that's why it's absolutely one of my favorite stories.
Oh, that was so special. Thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, we all have Wawatasee moments.
Exactly. Exactly.
What do your daughters think of the storytelling, and what do elders in the tribal council think of this?
So much good feedback, positive feedback. My daughters love it. Their peers do as well. Both my girls are in college now and they're having little watch parties in at their colleges for it. And we're having little watch parties around the state. But we've had thousands of people listen in. It's been really fantastic. And so we do have stories like that one, like kind of like, I guess you could qual I mean, a folklorist or an academic might qualify it as a how did that get to be kind of story, but also a lesson. But some of our folks just tell have also told, I should say, is histories. So they'll share histories of their community that maybe people don't know. And they share it from their own authentic voice, which is very different than just like reading it a book. So they'll say, my uncle was on the there, my auntie was on council at the time. So they just really make not only these delightful stories, like the one I just shared of Val's, but the histories come alive. And I've heard from a lot of teachers. Teachers love to use these stories, especially if it's kind of a cold day and they can't get outside. They can pop this video in, and it's a great lesson for the kids. And because the storytellers have such a varied background, you've got something like Lightning Bug, which anybody can learn from, but kind of maybe younger kids, and to like more complicated histories from some of our other storytellers that might be of interest to like high school or college age kids.
I love that. And you think about whenever then you see a firefly, you think of the story. You see the
Yes.
natural world in a whole new way.
Yes, and like you said, we've all been there.
Yes. So, what do you hope to do as you continue this storytelling series? January is wrapping up, but the stories continue. Where do you want to see these stories go?
Well, I love the fact that we're recording them and that they're going to live there forever. And I love the fact that all these people have their unique styles. So next year, we're hoping to continue it again. It may broaden, it may change. I'm not sure where they're going with that. But one of the positive benefits that I've since I've been doing this is I get emails or messages from Ojibwe people across this country and Canada. So every single reservation in Wisconsin, or Ojibwe reservation, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, Michigan, even Turtle Mountain out in North Dakota, they're all listening and they're talking and they're sharing. And I love that we're learning and getting the sounds like a terrible pun, getting the bands back together. They're able to talk to each other and communicate and share because we have different stories in our different places and our brothers and sisters up in Canada. So it's been, I really love that part. I really love that part that we can come around and share those stories.
Liz, this has been really special. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for sharing your story.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Liz Arbuckle is a senior councilwoman on the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Tribal Council and Northern Outreach Coordinator for the Wisconsin Historical Society. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the ability of artificial intelligence chatbots to detect fake news with new research out from a UW Stout computer scientist. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Winter has a way of wearing you down, but there are ways to get by. And producer Steve Gotcher has found one way to cope.
Winter can take its toll on your mind. The walls close in, the sky is gray, and the snow piles up. Every morning you bundle up, scrape the windshield, crank the heat, trudge to work. Then the call comes.
Hey Steve, it's John. Wanna play a little poker Saturday night around 7:30? Give me a call and let me know if you're in. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
That call means there's a reason to keep going, if only until Saturday. Yep, it's poker on Saturday night. But this isn't just any poker game. It's all about the location. From the street, the house on Madison's Near East Side looks like all the rest, but a short walk down the narrow drive to the tiny backyard reveals an unexpected scene. Christmas trees snatched from the curb are arranged in the deep snow surrounding a 12 by 14 foot canvas cabin tent. A short path has been shoveled to the zipper that opens the flaps. Nearby, bottles of beer poke out of the snowbank. Candle lanterns light the backyard, and a warm glow emanates from the kerosene lanterns inside. Smoke curls from the stovepipe, poking out of the roof. Inside, a large wood stove puts out ample heat and warms every corner. An old toboggan sitting on crates holds a lantern, a few half-full whiskey bottles, and an assortment of cups and glasses. There's an old dining room table and chairs with a couple of lanterns, some bowls of chips, and a deck of cards in the middle of the tent. People filter in and take their place at the table, each with a container full of change and a beverage of choice. The smell of kerosene, wood smoke, and canvas permeates as our eyes adjust to the lantern light.
All right, what do you say?
Let's play poker.
Yeah.
Want to cut? Okay, we're going to do a seven-card stud.
John, our host, deals the first hand, and everyone throws in a quarter, the maximum bet, as cards get dealt around the table. Five-card draw, seven-card stud, between the sheets, guts, Texas Hold'em, seven-card no peek. Each new dealer picks their favorite game.
For that, I'll bet a quarter.
I just put in a quarter.
Thanks for the prompt.
You put a quarter in, right?
Yes, I did. I did, absolutely.
Just keeping these guys on.
Yeah,
it's easy to play if you don't have to put any money in.
As the game progresses, the city melts away, and you can imagine that the tent is somewhere in the deep woods, far away where no one can find you. The mood is easy, and the cares of the outside world are forgotten for now. Table talk flows from the weather to how are the kids doing, what's up at work, and how much is that current bet? It's an evening of pleasant conversation with moments of deep concentration as players contemplate whether to bet or fold. The excitement grows with the pot until someone lays down the winning hand and rakes in the small pile of change in the center of the table. A night of poker in the tent with the snow, the discarded Christmas trees, and the wood heat is a transcendent experience. It's a great escape from the icy cold of winter while embracing it at the same time.
Really? On that Jack 10, huh?
I'm going to step out on this.
Wow.
Look at that.
Just like that.
I'm always delighted when I get the call that there will be poker on Saturday night. All right. But right now, there's time for one more hand. And that's a good thing, because baby needs new shoes. Well, don't let's
your deal go down. I never let your deal go down. Well, don't let your deal go down till your last old dollar is gone.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We examine the ability of artificial intelligence tools like ChatGPT to debunk made-up news. A study examines the extent to which AI chatbots can identify the authenticity and the credibility of news articles. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kevin Karamanchin is an assistant professor of computer networking and information technology at UW-Stout. Kevin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
So you tested the fact-checking abilities of four large language models, including two versions of ChatGPT. Oh. And large language models are these trained on, you know, vast amounts of data to then generate language. And you use this technology to detect made-up news stories. How well did these AI tools do in this work?
That is correct. Now, these AI large language models, well, compared to human subjects, compared to your average information consumers, they performed higher. But as an AI language model, the result that, you know, they generated, the yield outcome, is actually far from perfect. And so we are still looking at their future refinement and improvement so that in the future, they're going to be more reliable when it comes to news fact checking, especially.
So they are far from perfect, you said.
Perfect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. What have you observed in this process?
So in this process, one of the advantages of this ALR language models compared to your human fact checkers, one is the speed. The speed really, really is so remarkable that the explanation, the justification why a news headline is deemed as true, false, partially true, partially false, you know, the justification and the judgment are all given, you know, in a matter of seconds. Now, if you're going to rely on a human fact checker, although it can be or they can be more reliable, they typically take their time, you know, although their accuracy, you know, compared to these large language models are going to be really, really higher.
Okay, so you sacrifice speed for being able to suss out what is true. So I guess there's some give and take there. How did you go about testing the large language models? How did you set this up?
Oh, yeah, it's actually a very interesting study because prior to this, you know, ChatGPT, you know, it's fairly new. And I've seen so many tests and use cases wherein they've tested ChatGPT. Can it pass, you know, SAT? What is the IQ of ChatGPT? You know, random fact or random questions. We even have some use cases wherein they're testing large language models, how efficient or how accurate they are in making codes. So when I first started this study, what I did was, wait a minute, how about the ability of these large language models to detect and recognize misinformation or news fact-checking? And news fact-checking, compared to your generic, you know, always factual information, they tend to be dynamic in nature for their legitimacy. One news information now, eventually in the future, weeks, months from now, can be debunked. So really, that's what I wanted to check, like how consistent these large language models are with the current legitimacy of the news items. And so the way I did it is that I've chosen the four most prominent large language models. That's, again, ChatGPT, Bard, and then AI Bing. At that time, AI Bing is not yet integrated with ChatGPT. And then, you know, I tested them like a human, like my regular test or human subjects and testing. Are you able to detect it? I've given them three options. I'm going to present to you news headlines, news articles, and tell me if it is true, if it is not, or if it is partially true and partially or partially false. Now, compared to human subjects, what I've noticed is that they really can be more accurate, you know, especially in that middle ground, partially true and partially false. Usually human subjects tend to, you know, just choose black and white. Oh, that's actual, outright false, outright true. But there are new subjects that are really partial when it comes to their legitimacy. Yeah. So that's one aspect, that's one domain wherein this large language model really, really excel compared to your human subjects.
Okay, what would happen if you would replicate the study, you know, months or even a year later? Do you think you would find the same results?
Replication of my study right now, actually, it was months ago when I first did that. It's going to be more refined, the large language models. The training data now have been updated.
Mm-hmm.
When I first did my study, the training data that I referenced in, most of them have got off dates, and so I faithfully used that only up to April 2021. But now, these large language models, they have really, really very recent training data. And not just that, the AI large language companies, they know that if you are asking, or if a consumer is asking for news or journalistic information, instead of making the large language model outright answer the legitimacy of that news, what the large language model is actually giving out as an output is a link to a web link that shows references, so that they are actually passing the responsibility to the consumers to decide if, based on what you are seeing, decide for yourself if this news is true, false, or partially true and partially false.
So leading you there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Instead of making the large language models themselves decide and, you know, be the truth arbiter, if you will.
Can you apply this to the world we're living in right now as we look ahead to the elections in Wisconsin and certainly people paying attention to news about the races for president and Congress? How helpful to voters is AI for identifying election misinformation?
So far, yeah. So far, actually, this I actually did a preliminary study about that, about because of this upcoming 2024 election. And so far, from what I've observed, they're still very accurate. No, the facts, the information that these large language models are spitting out, especially when it comes to 2024 elections, are really accurate. For example, I tested out after the former president Donald Trump just won the Iowa caucus. Who won that one? And it's actually accurate that in real time they actually provided that the former president won that caucus.
So it was able to really pick up very recent news and be able to translate it correctly. There's a global survey of news organizations finding journalists are interested in using AI for time-sensitive duties like, you know, interview transcription and fact-checking. Is there a role, do you think, in newsrooms for AI fact-checking?
Definitely. You know, the thing about deceptions, misinformation, and disinformation is that they, some of their form, if not most of their form are actually just, you know, they tend to come over and over again, even though they've already been debunked in the past. And so the role that I see these large language models are going to come in is when it comes to those persistent deceptions that keeps coming in, that some new information users or news viewers are not able to yet, you know, familiarize themselves with.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the speed, with the justification, with the detailed thorough explanation of these large language models, they can really be used to educate users and information, especially when you were searching for one certain subject that you were really not very much a background on and aware of. These can really be helpful, especially one of their strengths is to give you an explanation in layman's term. Why is that not true? Or why is that claim most likely not feasible, if you will?
Okay, so breaking down more complex terms into clearer language. Kevin Karamanchian is an assistant professor of computer science at UW-Stout. We dive into the growing field of artificial intelligence and the capabilities of generative chatbots. Call in with a question. You can share concerns at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the potential for artificial intelligence chatbots like ChatGPT to discern false data and fake news. Research out of UW-Stout examines the capabilities of these large language models to pick out facts from misinformation. Call in with a question. You can share your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kevin Karamanchian is an assistant professor of computer science at UW-Stout. So, Kevin, you tested the fact-checking capabilities of several large language models. And since then, since you did this last spring, the AI detection tracker NewsGuard estimates the number of sites hosting AI-created false articles has increased from 49 sites to more than 600. And some sites generate up to thousands of articles a day. Do you think can fact-checking AI offset this deluge of AI-created misinformation?
That is the very, very reason that I tested them out in the first place. AI-powered deceptions are just going to grow enormously in vast numbers, in vast amount. And it's going to be really almost next to impossible for human fact-checkers to, you know, verify each of those AI-powered articles, news headlines. And so really, what you want is also an AI-powered mechanism to detect, go heads-on with those AI-powered tools. Mm-hmm.
Do you think, like, could multiple chatbots debate each other on the facts or the made-up stuff in an article? Could you put, like, chatbots together on this as a team? And debate each other?
Definitely. What people have to realize is that large language models or chatbots, they are actually based on training data. Training data are usually in forms of text, images, audio, videos even, just your typical form of data. Now, depending on what it is trained on, that is going to be the truth that AI model is going to be referencing in. So for example, hypothetically, if you have one consumer base or if you have one group of people that doesn't seem to agree with what this AI large language model is, you know, saying or giving to them, they may look for other AI large language models to, you know, reference. Wait a minute, I don't agree to the facts that this AI is saying or telling me. I'm just going to look for other AI large language model to reference or to look up to or to ask. And that is certainly possible.
But if these chatbots themselves make stuff up from time to time, I mean, we've heard about being, you know, prone to hallucination as a flaw, then why would we want them on a task like this?
First, usually when we put these AI large language models on tasks like this, we don't render their judgments as final. Usually what happens is that after they have flagged, for example, in social networking sites, by the way, have been using this for a very long time now. After, for example, a news article has been flagged as potentially deceptive, there is going to be a human subject in the background after that flag had happened who's going to verify if that is deceptive. But, I mean, as you can see, it actually hastens the process of fact-checking.
So we're seeing here in Wired that reporting that more than 88% of American news outlets are blocking AI companies from collecting data for their chatbots. So that, you know, but leading right-wing news outlets mostly resist blocking. And, you know, as you look at web scraping then and the ability to you know, allow these chatbots to collect training data, could this dynamic affect the development of AI chatbots?
Definitely, definitely. And I understand from the point of your social networking media sites is that they tend to have user data, and we don't want these AI chatbots to actually implicitly or accidentally learn of user data that may intrude privacy. You know, you can have an issue about that, you know? And also, for the most part, it's actually proprietary on these large language models what their training data is based or referencing in. And that's actually what makes an AI large language model, you know, perform worse or better than other large language models. And so right now, for my study, and there are in many, many other several studies too, what we want to figure out is, what really have you been using as training data on your large language models? Can we trust them? How do we trust them if you're not going to, you know, make this open or make us known of it? No.
That, and certainly you have to know that information of what data it's collecting so that you can even run experiments that, you know, that are legitimate, that you can count on as well, I would imagine. So in our last moments together, how should news consumers look out for misinformation that's disguised as legitimate news?
So what we want to know, the news consumers, is that these are just tools, you know. AI large language models, they are just there to guide you in pursuit of the truth. You can use them to generate clues, ideas, why likely one misinformation is true, why is it false or partially true or partially false. But eventually, at the end of the day, all of these filters will all go down to you as the final decision agent and deciding for yourself if the news information that you were consuming is actually true or not.
So using it as a helper, not a replacement.
You are still the agent as a news consumer, and you owe that to yourself.
Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Kevin Karamanchian is an assistant professor of computer networking and information technology at UW-Stout. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Access to healthcare in the Chippewa Valley is shrinking, with news that two Hospital Sisters Health System locations, HSHS Sacred Heart and HSHS St. Joseph's, those hospitals are slated to close in Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls. And then Previa Health announced plans to shut down its clinics throughout the region. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kristen Abbott-Anderson is Dean of the College of Nursing and Health Sciences at UW-Eau Claire. Kristen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me.
What do you make of these closure announcements?
Oh, my goodness. To say that I, along with our community and our College of Nursing, were shocked is probably an understatement. Surprised, and then I think quickly followed on the heels was sadness or a grief for the situation. This is a hospital system that has been a part of our Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls communities for decades, and in fact, our college has had a clinical partner relationship with HSHS Sacred Heart since the beginning of our program in 1965. Mm. So they've been a valued partner in our community, and we grieve this loss, and we also are concerned for the employees that are impacted, and of course the patients that will need to search for access to other healthcare providers in the area.
HSHS says more than 1,400 employees will be affected by the hospital closures, and you oversee nursing education at UW-Eau Claire. How do students feel about the expected closures in this news? How are they processing it?
Sure. At this point, I have to be honest and say it's a little hard to say. Our students return to classes next Monday. Our faculty that were in charge of leading these clinical sections that would have shortly begun have reached out to students immediately and to assure them that work is being done to find alternate clinical experiences. And the students to date have seemed to be taking this in stride. There doesn't seem to be a lot of angst on their side. But as I said, we don't have them on campus at this point. And so I think that there will be some additional support needs that we will be seeing in the next week. And I also want to highlight the fact that we do have current students who were also employees as, you know, maybe certified nursing assistants at HSHS. And so they are students that are potentially doubly impacted.
Mm. Let's take a call now. Mark and Bloomer. Mark, hi, go ahead.
Hey, I called to say I am, not was, but I am a hospice chaplain. I will be a hospice chaplain moving forward. I worked for St. Joe's, and what kills me is that the health and the soul of our community was merely a line item in somebody else's budget. The people who work at HSHS Prevea, we're going to get jobs because we are some of the best out there. That's why we were hired by HSHS. What kills me, though, is the health and the soul of our community was gutted because of a line item in somebody's budget somewhere.
Mark, thank you for calling in. And the organization cited prolonged operational and financial stress related to the pandemic, inflation, and workforce constraints, end quote. Kristen, what do you make of the complexity of that?
Oh, my goodness. I think we would probably need much, much more time to discuss the intricacies of this. However, I think the caller brings up such an important point, how hospital organizations, they're more than just brick and mortar and, you know, the services they provide. They are a place where history is made in individuals' families. It's where your children were born. It's where you've had the opportunity to establish connections with providers in long-term provider-patient relationships. And I don't think that the value of those types of impacts are readily recognized. And I think that it's going to be important as we move forward that we recognize that there is a sense of grief and loss, and that our community will be needing to address that and to come together as a community to support those that are, impacted most.
Kristen Abbott-Anderson is with us, Dean of the College of Nursing and Health Sciences at UW-Eau Claire, as we talk about hospital closures on the horizon in western Wisconsin. You can join in with questions, your comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Kristen, what options will remain for UW-Eau Claire students to receive the clinicals, the in-person training locally?
Well, we are extremely fortunate to have additional clinical partners within Eau Claire, and these partners have immediately reached out to offer any and all assistance that they can make possible to our students. And I think that says a lot about the partnerships that we have and the quality of the partners that we have here in Eau Claire. So though we haven't finalized our plan, we are close to finalizing a plan, but I'm confident that with the support of our current partners in Eau Claire and also just within our College of Nursing and the resourcefulness that we have available to us here, we will find an effective solution for these students.
And last week, Marshfield Clinic Health System reported it would furlough about 360 employees, and that came less than 2 weeks before plans to merge with Essentia Health, Duluth-based Essentia. Are the financial challenges you're seeing in healthcare affecting workforce recruitment and training?
Boy, another deep question, because yes, you know, a key to nursing education is, of course, having those available clinical sites in order to train our healthcare professionals. And that goes beyond nursing, but nursing is a large part of it. If we don't have access to hospital units due to staffing shortages, due to budget constraints, then that limits the number of opportunities that our students can have to be trained in a broad array of clinical experiences. And so it most definitely impacts training. And it just adds to sort of the challenges that we have been seeing in terms of just in general, the nursing shortage, and also nurse faculty shortage, and the need to graduate far more nurses than we currently are able to do.
The CEO of Hospital Sisters Health System, Damon Boatwright, in 2021 spoke with Health News Illinois and talked about rebuilding the system in the wake of the pandemic.
Part of the vision is to rebuild now, sort of HSHS over the next year or two, so then we can sort of reimagine what HSHS needs to be in a post-pandemic world and remain relevant, financially vibrant, and help our communities grow.
And so, Kristen, how is healthcare education different today than before the COVID-19 pandemic?
You know, I would say probably the most significant change in education is the fact that we have fewer students actually applying for nursing school. And that's not limited to our own experience. It is state and nationwide. And part of that, I believe, is the impact of the public watching nurses struggle through the COVID pandemic and the negative impact on, I think, perceptions of the nursing profession. And so that has created a situation where we have fewer students that are applying, which is unheard of, really, in the past in nursing education. We consistently had wait lists of students just, you know, clamoring to get into the nursing program, and sort of a, you know, a wealth of potential students and resources to you know, potentially build our programs and to graduate additional nurses. Now we're faced with something that's, you know, that's unforeseen or just uncommon within nursing education. I mean, so it has been detrimental to our programs. Coupled with that, we have a shortage of nursing faculty, as you may be aware. Many nursing programs are working with fewer nursing faculty than they have in previous years, where perhaps faculty leave a position and that position is just not filled. So that, in addition to these types of hospital closures, even in closures of just units within a hospital, all has an impact on educating new nurses who are prepared to go out and care for those in our community.
Kristen Abbott-Anderson, Dean of the College of Nursing and Health Sciences at UW-Eau Claire, sharing perspective on how healthcare is changing in Western Wisconsin with hospital and clinic closures. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the changing landscape of healthcare in western Wisconsin as Previa Health plans to shutter its clinics in coming months, and two hospitals are slated to close in Chippewa Falls and Eau Claire in April. Call in with a question. You can share your views, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kristen Abbott-Anderson is Dean of the College of Nursing and Health Sciences at UW-Eau Claire. Let's bring in Mike in Bruce. Mike, hi, go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I know there's many causes for what's going on, at least that's what I'm hearing. But I just wonder also if it's a wake-up call for the legislators to re-examine taking Medicaid relief. I guess Wisconsin's only one of 10 states that hasn't taken that. In these small rural communities, not economically strong, maybe that could have helped as well. So,
Mike, thanks for the call. Another big question, Kristen, as we look at federal health programs and reimbursement rates.
Yes. Yes, so I think that is one aspect of what we're seeing here. And I know in the governor's State of the State address, he initiated the idea of a task force to focus on the state's healthcare industry challenges. And this seems, I think, very timely and an important focus. And I think this is one way to get at some of these aspects, because we know, you know, the Medicaid decision is most certainly impacting, you know, the financial bottom line of our healthcare institutions. I believe there are probably many other financial impacts that are also contributing to some of these challenges. And I did see just a recent report from the hospital CFO report. I wanted to look nationally what was happening and how often the shuttering of actual hospital buildings happens nationally, and it's very infrequent. What we typically will see is, you know, a closing of units, and most of these tend to be OB and mental health units. But I think in my quick review of the information out of these 72 recent closings and of drawing down of services, I believe there was only one other brick and mortar hospital building actually shuttered.
So you're saying that the shuttering, the closure of distressed hospitals is quite rare in America. And here we are in Wisconsin seeing two in a matter of months.
Right. And I would add a caveat to that. I think when we're looking at hospitals, a hospital like HSHS here in Eau Claire and in Chippewa Valley, they each had over 100 beds. So these are good sized hospitals and probably would not fit the definition of what we would call a rural hospital. Our rural hospitals nationally have had greater impacts from closing. That's not so true here in Wisconsin, but it is true across the nation. I think sometimes those smaller hospitals, they serve critical areas. They're critical access hospitals that allow those that live in that community to access care more quickly and efficiently. And when those are shuttered, then those in the rural communities are having to drive further, and you know, there's greater risk for negative health care outcomes. But I think each of these partial or full closures of brick and mortar sites really serves as an alarm bell that needs our immediate attention. And we need to begin an arduous task of doing a deep dive into what is happening with our healthcare systems, from the brick and mortar all the way up to the highest leadership, the cost of healthcare, billing structures, insurance factors, and the impact of Medicaid. But this, as you can understand, is highly complex and will require the diligence of collective work of a diverse team, and a team that can see the complexity of these issues and at the same time identify priorities that will bring some immediate change. And I'm hopeful that the task force that Governor Evers is establishing is a place to start, but I believe that work needs to begin immediately.
Kristen Abbott Anderson, Dean of the College of Nursing and Health Sciences at UW-Eau Claire, as we look at hospital closures, clinic closures in Western Wisconsin, and next steps. You can call in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Kristen, for people not in the Chippewa Valley, you know, we hear terminology like healthcare desert or medical desert. What will be your analysis on what access people do have? Do you see this more of a desert now with these looming closures?
Most definitely. I mean, I think we, you know, have already begun to see some of those impacts. In perhaps not as much in Wisconsin as we've been able to sustain some of our critical access hospitals, I think more effectively than other states, but, you know, we risk expectant mothers delivering somewhere on the freeway in a snowstorm, you know, because they have to drive 75 miles, 100 miles to a hospital to safely deliver their baby. If we think about, you know, the aging of our rural communities and the healthcare needs associated simply with aging, the chronic conditions that many of our community members live with, and not having the ongoing access to local healthcare where there can be a more proactive approach to healthcare, to a prevention-minded strategy for healthcare, which is always our goal. And so with the lack of a hospital or a clinic in your community, it is a healthcare desert. And we leave our rural dwelling community members with little to no options.
You mentioned Governor Tony Evers delivering this annual State of the State address and announcing a new task force. In that address, Governor Evers declared 2024 the year of the worker, and the state's Workforce Development Agency says Wisconsin faces a potential deficit of 20,000 nurses by 2040. What would happen with a deficit of that scale?
Oh. I don't want to envision that. I think that what we're seeing today would be exponentially worse. Mm-hmm. We currently have on the range of about 3,600 job openings annually for nurses across the state of Wisconsin. And at this time, we graduate on average 3,000 nurses per year. So you can see how that deficit does grow. And over the next 10 to 15 years, we're going to continue to see that grow unless we make some significant changes.
Making some significant changes in the weeks and months ahead, in our last few moments together, what are those next steps?
No, I think, as I mentioned, this is an extremely complex issue, and I don't want to put too simple a point on it, but I think I'll focus this last moment on maybe some ideas for how we can enhance or increase the number of nurses that we have that are pursuing a nursing education. I think one is that, you know, nursing schools need to see each other as partners in this effort. There has been a great deal of, you know, competition. I think that's normal. But I think we need to begin to shift that focus on the fact that we have a common goal of graduating
all in this together and graduating nurses. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your insights.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kristen Abbott Anderson, Dean of the College of Nursing and Health Sciences at UW-Eau Claire, on the morning show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. How much paper junk mail, as we like to call it, gets delivered to your mailbox, and what to do about it? That question, it came up on a recent caller-only request show. Dale in Waukesha told us they've kept track of the amount of junk mail that hits their mailbox since the start of the year.
And I have over 400 pieces of junk mail. I carried out about 15 pounds out to recycling yesterday.
Call in with your questions about unwanted mail. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michelle Reinen is Policy Initiatives Advisor for the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. The division is within the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Michelle, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me, and what an excellent subject. I'm so excited we're talking about this.
Good. Yeah. So what does your state agency consider to be, quote, air quotes here, junk mail?
Well, that's a very complicated question. I mean, as heard by that listener, 400 pieces of junk mail, over 400 pieces of junk mail. And some of that is direct marketing. You know, companies still find it very valuable and useful to do direct marketing where they are mailing individual residents with their solicitations and promotions. And then we see scammers out there who are creating misrepresentations and just trying to get people to hand over their personal information and make payments. And that's where the department comes in, making sure legitimate companies aren't misrepresenting their advertisements through mailers, those direct pieces, and that scammers aren't using tactics to try and get people to turn over their information. And we certainly take complaints on those issues and try and track them down and bring cases and actions against them.
Well, just considering how much is out there, that must be a big, you know, a sizable task, since, you know, the average household receives hundreds of pieces of this mail and these solicitations each year. Can you step back a few steps? How do companies get people's names?
Well, there are many different mailing lists out there. Legitimate companies go to other companies that put together mailing lists. One of them would be the Direct Marketing Association, a national organization that puts together data that's publicly available and where individuals submit that information. Think filling out a warranty card. A consumer submits their name and address there. There are public records about where individuals live. And that's if your mailer is sent directly to you using your name and address. And then there are companies who just use all the addresses listed in a municipality without having names on them. And so you may, when you pay attention, it may just say residential or resident or residential customer. It's not actually using your personal information, just your address information, which again is publicly available, all the residents in a municipality.
So, you know, exploring a bit more here, you know, with data brokers and these companies buying contact lists, and they're you know, using, collecting, aggregating that consumer data. And eventually it comes out in perhaps some type of solicitation to you in your mailbox. Can you remove yourself from these data broker sites?
Yeah, there are different ways to approach this. The first step is to, as you mentioned, minimize the amount of mail. And so the Direct Marketing Association allows you to remove your name from their list, and you can contact them. And we have all these details on our website, so you can go there, and we have brochures that contain that information as well. But you can go to the Direct Marketing Association and have your name removed so it's not further sold. But the problem is those companies that already have your information, and now they may continue to use it or resell that information. So you have to go individually to those companies and ask to be removed from those mailing lists. You should contact your financial institution and ask them to be sure that they're not sharing your information with their customers and vendors. If you read the privacy policies that you receive from your financial institutions, they're required to notify you of your right to stop them from sharing your personal financial information with outside companies. But as we've all experienced, those privacy policies are pretty detailed, And we probably don't pay attention to everything that's in them, including this right to opt out. But you do have that, and you can ask them to remove your name. Paying attention when you do sign up for new things to make sure boxes aren't auto-clicked and checked, so your information won't be automatically shared with others, vendors that they have. And that's how it continues to pass forward. Credit card offers, you know, there's a place to remove your name. Optoutprescreen.com is a place where you can go to make sure you're not getting pre-approved credit card offers, another form of junk mail that's out there that people likely don't want to receive for fear of identity theft should someone get their hands on that inappropriately.
But if you remove your name and you take these independent steps, detailed steps, is that forever? I mean, how long does that last?
Excellent point. It's not forever. Most of these lists have limitations. So I believe the Direct Marketing Association is for 10 years and the opt-out pre-screen, if I'm remembering right, is for 5 years. Even if you remove your name from the Department of Transportation, if you buy a new vehicle and you want to opt out there, they may still need to give your information if the number of records being requested is under a particular number. I think it's 10. So it's something you need to continue to stay on top of and renew. But when you minimize your sharing of information and change your habits about filling out sweepstakes forms or those the filling out surveys or the warranty cards, you'll be minimizing the information you share for those companies to pass it on and then continue to pass it on in that waterfall effect.
Michelle Reinen with us from the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection's Division of Consumer Protection, and she's the Policy Initiatives Advisor as we talk about paper junk mail and what to do about it. You can join in with your question, your insights, what you have done, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We heard from Cheryl, emailed and says that this is what they do, Michelle. If there is a postage paid return envelope inside, they will send it back empty and tell the sender to take them off the list. And Cheryl says it actually works most of the time. And Cheryl goes on to say it makes them giggle every time they think about helping out the post office at the same time as causing the culprit to spend money on their empty return.
Yeah, that's a great tip, and something that you can do is just return to sender the information so you no longer want it. That is a good tactic. They're not handing over any of their personal information. They're not confirming anything or engaging other than to take me off your mailing list, which is a legitimate request of a consumer to any business.
I've also heard you can write the word refused on any mail in the U.S. Does that make a difference?
That will get the mail back. Uh-huh. I don't know if that will actually remove your information from their internal list. If any caller's been doing that, it'd be interested to see if they then never receive new mail from that particular company.
Let's talk about those privacy concerns and recycling this mail, what to recycle, what not to. Is it generally safe to throw away mail with an address on it? Can you recycle it?
Well, so in my household, we just tear off that portion of the mailing label and make sure that we're shredding that. But again, take a look at what's on it because it is public information. But we're just doing that extra step to make sure that we are removing it. But pay attention to those pre-approved credit card offers that are usually pre-printed forms. You'll want to take that piece of the paperwork and shred it. Anything that will have an account number on it or a pre-assigned, you know, pre-approved, pre-assigned account number, some catalog companies, if you will, that still exist, that are trying to get you as customers will give you an account number with their company, and then your address information will be there. So that's worth ripping off and shredding that to be sure no one else starts to impersonate you, identity theft, and open an account with that company and place orders and then redirect where things are being shipped. And it's all then happening in your name and under your, you know, pre-established account number. So it is worth shredding anything that does contain your personal information on it.
Michelle Reinen is Policy Initiatives Advisor at the State Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Call in with your questions about junk mail, what you consider to be junk mail, 800-642-1234 to join in. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With billions of pieces of junk mail circulating in our country each year, we learn how to cut down on these ad solicitations, like credit card offers and catalogs getting shoved into our mailbox. Join in at any point with your observations, your solutions. Call in with a question about the tide of unwanted mail, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Michelle Reinen is Policy Initiatives Advisor at the State Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Let's bring in Mary in Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I just had a comment that the Postal Service does not return those when you write refused or returned to sender. It is considered what we call third class mail. You guys call it junk mail, but we call it third class mail, and it gets thrown away. So either the customer throws it away or we throw it away, but it does not go back when you refuse it or return. I just wanted to make that clear. You're better off, and I have personal knowledge because I had a parent who died and needed to be taken off list. You personally have to write a letter to them and request them being taken off, maybe because of a deceased situation or because you would just like to be removed. Just a little helpful hint.
Mary, this is so helpful. Thank you so much for that. Michelle.
That's great to know that it's not getting there. It answers the question we asked, will it really remove your name from the list? So thanks so much, Mary. And you know, that's that effort we talked about of having to make that individual contact. And now we know you're going to have to write that letter. Some companies may have a website where you can go to and provide that information to be removed from mailing lists. But otherwise it will be that letter piece of it in making the actual connection. So thanks so much, Mary, for letting us know. It's not making the connection when you send it back that way.
Christian in Milwaukee. Hi, go ahead, Christian.
Hello. So I was wondering, I've called Capital One like 2, 3, maybe even 4 times telling them to stop sending me anything, and they just don't stop. Can I sue them for like harassment or something?
Christian,
I'm not.
Thank you, Christian.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I'm not aware of any state legislation that would allow for that, or even federal legislation that would allow you to sue them. And contacting them by phone is one thing. They're not making phone calls. There are things about harassment with phone calls, but you'd want to put it in writing. So you also have documentation to that contact and verifying that the mailers are actually coming from that company directly and not marketers on their behalf that are trying to make connections for profit in helping build their business as well. So there's a lot going on behind the scenes with some of these marketing pieces. So one place to start is optoutprescreen.com, because that's about pre-approved credit card offers.
That's a great tip, Christian. Thank you. Alec in La Crosse. Alec, hi. What is your question?
Hi. My question is, it seems like the interests of advertisers or companies is being prioritized over the privacy of individuals. is there any movement or legislation in the works to change that?
I think what you're asking is there a do not mail me list similar to a do not call, where there was a movement to make sure that solicitations couldn't come by phone when you desired. I'm not aware of anything as it relates to mail other than these different contacts to be sure that you can request that your name be removed from lists and that the financial institutions have to, through their privacy policy, inform you that you have the right to opt out. But I'm not aware of any do not mail me list broad like that under any regulations.
But more broadly, is there a correlation between paper junk mail and the telemarketing calls?
Well, there could be in that, again, it's data brokers just collecting information about you and sending those leads or selling those leads to marketers. Some go by mail and some will make phone calls. Now, for that phone call to be legitimate, they would need to be a registered telemarketer in the state of Wisconsin. If you are on the do not call list, then they should not be contacting you with that solicitation. And this is a federal legislation as well. So if you're listening from outside Wisconsin, you could be protected that way. And so it all goes back to the amount of information you share and have available about yourself. One thing I try to do is not give out my cell phone number, just so it can't compound like a home phone number can, because it's out there in a phone book type situation.
You know, it seems like there have been strides with emails and hitting the unsubscribe button at the bottom of the email that and being able to not get those emails. And I'm just wondering, you know, why doesn't the solicitation with the paper mail have some sort of way that the consumer can clearly get rid of it if they don't want it by either going to a particular place or site or being able to, quote unquote, unsubscribe more easily, more systematically?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there are online options for filling out the different forms, but there is the constant renewal. And when you're doing the unsubscribe, you are usually contacting that individual company, and some will have the option to go to a website when you don't want to receive the mailer or catalog or call the 800 number. But those, again, are those legitimate companies that are listening to their customers versus some who are just trying to build lists, the data brokers that are out there, or the scammers. I mean, there are plenty of companies or, you know, fake companies trying to engage you and aren't using good customer service tactics, if you will, in trying to entice you to engage and just get your information and money from them.
Michelle Reinen is Policy Initiatives Advisor at the State Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. As we dive deeply into junk mail, its origins, and how to get off these mailing lists, you can call in at 800-642-1234. Jeff in Appleton is with us. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. You know, the junk mail really doesn't mean a ton to me. You kind of touched on the phone. The junk mail is, I walk in the house past the recycle bin, I can just drop it in. Doesn't mean a ton to me. But yeah, the spam calls, the email, one thing you mentioned, the unsubscribe links. Many times people that are bad actors will use that unsubscribe link to actually infect your computer with malware. So you can't necessarily trust that either. But the spam calls are really the more annoying thing to me. You can't really stop them from coming in, and that's really annoying.
Jeff, thank you. Michelle, any tips there?
Love it. Love the question. At the end of 2019, federal legislation was passed in regards to requiring telecommunications providers to authenticate phone numbers. And over the course of the next 2 years, we saw that being implemented and have seen a reduction in phone calls to individuals from scammers. Plus, consumers are seeing on their smart devices labels such as scam likely, scam, unknown number, to give them a trigger to not answer and engage with that phone call because they can't authenticate where it's coming from. So they have become less reported, less annoying because there are less of them out there. And we are seeing continued efforts in that realm. And I love the tip about the unsubscribe. That's usually one when we talk about identity theft specifically. If you can just program your device to take certain solicitations you receive regularly and have them go to your junk box, and then just glance at those without opening them and delete them. The ones I unsubscribe to are companies that I've legitimately engaged with to maybe make a purchase and forgot to uncheck the box that says, you can send me ads in the future. And otherwise, I do try to avoid hitting unsubscribe with emails I've never seen before, companies I've never engaged with.
Michelle, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. If consumers have questions, 1-800-422-7128 to get the brochures to have all this contact information on how to opt out.
Michelle Reinen is a policy initiatives advisor for the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. The division is within the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.